I'd like to welcome you all and hope that you will be comfortable through the evening. We have a very stimulating program for you, and I know that these seats sometimes get difficult after you've been here a while, but I have a feeling that you will be so interested in what's going on that you'll hardly be aware of the fact that the seats are uncushioned. This is our fourth annual Intergroup Education Conference. The first one in 1957 started with the idea that we ought to examine what it is we do and how we do it. I was not part of the school setting in 1957, but the test of the success of that conference is tonight's meeting, since through the years we have continued to examine and to evaluate what it is we do and how we do it. In the 1958 conference, which was on learning for living, Mr. Studer, in the introduction to the program, outlined the purposes and the aims of these conferences, and I'd like to read you from that so that you can see the continuity of the work that we've been doing through the years. In the 58 program, Mr. Studer said, "The purpose of our annual intergroup conference is to bring together people who are searching for sound educational approaches toward human relations that square with our traditional beliefs in equality." In the 59 conference, we did just that, carrying on the convictions by which we think we are living in this school. And the conference last year was on achieving an integrated culture. At that point, we took a rather specific experience, the experience of Langston Hughes, who talked to the group about his own life and his own experiences in this kind of community. And the work done in the workshop the following day was an evaluation of an intergroup education program. Again, such a one as we have here in downtown community. In line with what we have been planning to do and hoping to do so that we know what we're doing and how we do it, the conference this year is to examine the materials available and possibly the materials necessary for continuing a sound program of intergroup education. And tomorrow, more specifically, the workshops and the programs will be on the materials. We thought that one of the best ways that we could bring to this community a report on sound intergroup relations was to ask Dr. Horn of the New York City on intergroup relations to talk with us about what is being done in the city as a whole. I think, though, that Dr. Horn is going to talk with us about his experiences historically and chronologically up to the point that he is now able to be the executive director of the commission. I'm sorry you haven't had an opportunity to talk with Dr. Horn as I did earlier, because I have an idea that his own personal experiences would be very enlightening and very challenging to many of us here. Dr. Horn has his PhD in education, which he got some years ago after finishing school at City College here in New York, where he was a native son, and then going out to California. In his travels through the years, he got to Georgia not as an educator, but as a man recovering from an illness, and there he tells me he met two friends whose great conviction about a junior college in Fort Valley, Georgia, brought him to the staff of that college as the dean and then acting president. Sometime later, and then for 18 years, though it's hard to believe as I see Dr. Horn now, he worked for federal housing agencies out of Washington, D.C., where he was director of racial relations services. These services, I gather, a varied kind of program in various housing developments, various housing programs conducted by the federal government. Most recently, as you know, he has come back to New York City to be on the New York City Commission for Intergroup Relations. It's around the work he does there and the work he has done in the past, both as an educator and as a fighter or an advocate, an exponent of sound intergroup relations, that I am pleased to bring you Dr. Horn tonight.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I believe when it was Frank Bonilla who first spoke to me about coming here tonight, I was inclined to say to him that my habit recently had been to listen a little more than to talk as much as I used to when I first came to town, and especially when I feel a sense of real humility and talking to people who are living by a practical, explicit experience, the very principles that some of us have been concerned about for a number of years of trying to get people to actually realize the validity of. However, as I looked into something about your school and what you were doing here, I said, well, if they think it'll help them any for me to say something about New York, I will. You see, I was raised in a rather interesting family, so that I didn't have many complications about intergroup relations. My family is of all colors. We have from browns to in-betweens to café au lait. We represent all colors that are usually identified with so-called Negro people. We were brought up in a family where I knew all about Sojourner Truth and Toussaint Louverture and all the other figures in Negro history as well as any other kind of history when I was a youngster, because it just happened our family was run that way. So that in this aspect I had to learn about racial relations in the sense that people talk about it today, and I really only began to learn it when I went south, way down into Georgia. Now, I won't take much time to talk about Georgia. You read about it in newspapers a good deal, and the atmosphere of race relations that's in a state like Georgia. And I taught school where there were only one race of people in the school, and the teaching force and the kids were all one race, all Negroes in a segregated school system. And I traveled all through the Southeast during that period, so I do know something about school systems that are not run such as this school certainly appears to be and is run. I'll say a little something about that before I'm through, because I believe this is at the root of something that's such an imperative nowadays that it's almost a point of survival. And I would like to start by complimenting you, and I noticed in making my notes I noticed there's more than one kind of school involved here, and one type of participating private schools. I see schools like the City and Country School and the Little Red Schoolhouse and New Lincoln School and Walden and Elizabeth Irwin High School and the Center for Human Relations at NYU. Maybe I overlook some of them, but this, I take it, has been because they were inspiring sort of centers for building the kind of human relations you're talking about. What interests me is that for years you have been not only preaching and talking about this, but practicing it in the way the school is run, its spirit and its leadership, and the type of accomplishment that is represented thereby. You, in a sense, have been doing some things that people have been talking about doing in New York City for some time and beginning to do, and in that sense you were sort of pioneers, and I would add my congratulations for such an interesting and sensitive type of tribute in this Nancy Block Award that is being made apparently for the fifth time here in this conference, and the publication and the outstanding list of books and judges that I see listed, and the fact that you have parents who actually did some of the reading and sifting beforehand, and that you are really gathering a library of materials and books of the type I see listed here is itself a distinctive contribution. And I will try to comment on that before I'm through why I say it that way. Now to identify myself a moment. The New York City Commission on Intergroup Relations, from its very title, is supposedly concerned with this subject. It's a regular city department, like the police department, the fire department, except that it's newer. It's only about 4 years old, but it has charged by the city council with two rather broad and important jobs. One, it says, we are to, by marshaling all the resources in the city, be they public and private, our job is, number one, to preclude, to stop, to help stop, to prevent any form of discrimination or segregation in the city that's based on race or religion or national origin. And this is defined as any difference of treatment whatsoever. The second charge, and a broader and larger one to us, is that we are to also mobilize the resources of the city to promote sound intergroup relations, to encourage them. This sounds a little strange in a city like New York, where its very sinew and essence and genius has been the fact that we have opened wide the doors of this town to people from all over the world and from every clime and race and religion you can imagine, and out of it have built these wondrous towers that everybody speaks of, and the real strength and power of the city, economic, social, art-wise, and everywhere else. But we're still having, some people are concerned because we're having new waves of migration, so to speak. We have some citizens coming from Puerto Rico, for example, that seem to be strange or new to people because they speak the Spanish language. Then there are waves of people coming up from the south, both Negroes and whites, because mechanization of southern agriculture is progressing so rapidly and the land can't support them anyhow, so that this tide is growing and will continue, so that you have people still coming into city of New York even though the great waves of immigration have been stopped by law. But it's so strange that as sophisticated a people as this city is supposed to represent, that has had problems with tremendous waves of immigration. When I was a youngster in the streets of New York, we were talking about waves of Italians, and earlier than that had been Irish, and then there were great armies of Jews. We absorbed millions of people, waves of migration running into the hundreds of thousands over short periods of time, and there were problems of adjustment, but we met them, and out of this have forged the thing that's our strength. Well, this commission that I'm on has 15 commissioners who serve without compensation. They have a technical staff that I direct that runs along up to about 50 people now, and we do a number of different kinds of things. I'll mention some of them rapidly in passing because some of them touch on what it is you're doing. Then I'll mention one special job that we're involved in the field of education itself to give you some notion of what I mean. This commission, by the way, is fundamentally a body which has limited policing powers. We investigate all kinds of complaints and problems that involve people of different kinds of racial or ethnic backgrounds. We can subpoena witnesses and records, we can hold hearings, but we can't put anybody in jail. We are fundamentally an educational body. We're fundamentally indulging in very specific ways in what people generally or sometimes loosely call intercultural or interracial education. And it occurs in many ways. We have as a basic goal and objective that we say we're trying to keep and maintain in New York what we like to call the open city. Now, some of you may are old enough to remember during the last war we had some open cities that we didn't bomb, but I'm not talking about that kind of an open city, but rather in the sense of the open arena, the open prize ring or the basketball field or the football field, where we say that it doesn't make any difference to us what your father's name is or what your mother's name is or where you came from or who your uncle or cousin is, but what can you produce in the open arena? The competition is for he who's got individual merit, individual skill, and regardless of anything else. So this is the essence of the open city, as we call it. So we take on one of our jobs is to work in every way we can to keep this an open city in every respect. And if anything, to find ways to make it more than just an open city, but rather a city that is taking the fullest possible advantage of people of various backgrounds and traditions and skills and interests to weld something even stronger, not as a melting pot so much as the old concept used to be, but rather the totality of strength is more than just two and two that sometimes make one and one that sometimes make two. Sometimes it can make a great deal more depending on what we've got to put in the pot. Because if you write one and one another way, it can make 11. This is the sinew we are after here now. And I said we had an imperative about it nowadays. It's almost a matter of survival. You know, there's a... We could work this out leisurely in New York and the other cities of the world if we did it as we usually do, but there's an imperative loose in the world right now. We're for the first time, and I say advisedly for the first time, really challenged worldwide about our position in the world. And I don't only mean economically challenged or even militarily only challenged, but we are challenged by an ideology that says it's got something better than we've got. They are ruthless in the way that they do it. And the Soviet Union has many more people and looks like they'll have a great many more individual people to play with if they really decide to so do than we ever will. It'll be an imperative with us that we identify and train to the fullest that we can every single individual that can has any aptitude whatsoever, because it'll be only the quality of our manpower and not its size that will win in this kind of endeavor, because I'm afraid this isn't going to be like a Hitler where a power of one kind, while he was experimenting with propaganda and so on. This is something vastly different, vastly deeper, and we have a great pressure of this kind. But this is not the only kind of pressure. There are pressures from within. You read your newspapers today and here is something going on in towns and states like Georgia and South Carolina, where students who happen to be Negroes are asserting a right to simply sit on a seat in a department store or a 5 and 10 to be served something to eat. This doesn't sound like it ought to be something so revolutionary, but if you've lived in these areas and you know that this represents a rare action on the part of these kids, this is a kind of courage that is reflected in the younger kids that you read about in Little Rock in the old day and previously. We had trouble in the South. This is a challenge to a restriction that has been accepted apparently for a long time by people. this is, if you had any sense of what in a southern city for a youngster to do that, what he has to face in the way of moral courage when he's not going to strike back in the process, means that there's a ferment going on here. It's almost one of the first historic moves I know of in American history where a student movement with political implications was attempting to shape political and human thinking in this country. There may have been other such student movements, but I know of none of them that have seemed to gather this momentum. Because you notice it is not something that's only affecting just Negro students. You notice what's happening. It's being picked up at Princeton and in Vassar and in Yale and various other places that are beginning to mold a unity of feeling here that that is a very significant action, no matter what happens to it, whether as the English did with the Indians for so long, whether their power was enough to suppress what finally Gandhi did by just a moral force, which was sort of a non-resistant opposition. Well, there is inherent in this business a moral imperative that is new to us. So we get into all kinds of things in our commission. We're concerned with the policies and the procedures of other governmental agencies. What's going on in the housing departments? Are there procedures along the lines of open policy and non-discrimination? What about the school system itself? And since I must hurry on because this is such a tempting field, in the school system itself, I went to school here as a youngster in a public school in Brooklyn. It's now in the middle of what's known as the Bedford-Stuyvesant section. I went to Boys High School in Brooklyn. And I never heard the question raised that there was that schools here were segregated by race. And it's been against the law here for years, but when I came back, one of the first things that came up in our studies was that because of residential patterns and other things of this nature, something like 70% of the public schools in this city were either 90% Negro and or Puerto Rican, or 90% or more what they euphemistically call others. Well, now, in Georgia, we would call these fundamentally segregated schools. And while we may blame it on the residential pattern, a good deal of it, well, I shouldn't say a good deal, I'll be more benign, I'll say some of it, had been the result of a process that politicians understand when you say gerrymandering. We sometimes draw irregular districts for schools in order that children will be included or excluded depending on who draws the lines. So that there's a process going on of redrawing the lines. And here I want to compliment the school system of New York because it has done several things about this. They have said not only are we concerned about equal education for everybody, but we even going far say we are ready to add services here to make up for cultural and social lags. This is quite a commitment from a school system. It's gone even further and said, we in this school, in this city, adopt the dictum of the Supreme Court, which really said that children kept apart because of race or ethnic origin. Now here's where they got away from the law. They said kids kept apart like this are damaged. Something happens to those children. Not only the colored or Negro children, but to the other children. They're damaged. I don't have time to go into the psychological business that I see a tape recorder here, but the mind is like this, and recent experiments show that these recordings don't get lost. They stay in there. And they sometimes come out in queer ways later in life. But they're all right there. And it would surprise me the way in southern schools that I saw in the Deep South, when you had little children, colored children standing up saluting the flag, I pledge allegiance to the flag, one nation indivisible, etc., etc., you know, doing justice for all. And I couldn't help but go through your mind, how fast are we teaching them double talk or double think? because they know that isn't true. They see every day the indignities, the insults, the deficiencies, the prohibitions, and back in the mind early this begins, and very early, and it stays in such ways that it gets twisted and distorted as it comes out. This is another one of the kinds of imperatives I'm talking about. So this city says, if it is true that children are damaged by this process, what does it do to the others, by the way? Well, those who don't happen to be colored get a false kind of a sense of a so-called superiority, or a false sense of the relationship to a people just because they look a little differently, or they're of a different color, so that their relationships later in life are distorted, so that they have difficulty way down the line that we should have erased earlier, so that both people are damaged. Well, if a city says, if the kids are damaged, then we ought to treat it like was polio or any other kind of rampant disease, and we ought to eradicate it if it's damaging. Some people do it because they have sense enough, as you do it here in this school. Others have been so ingrained in a system that it's hard to wake out of it, so we run into all kinds of difficulties about removing this source of damage to kids. And so we talk about integrating the school system. Many people get that thought mixed up, that what this means, just indiscriminate, we're going to mix everybody in every class, in every school, everywhere. But rather, we try to conceive it as a process that mainly is saying we should be alert to remove any obstacle of any kind, be it of a law or a policy or a practice, that prevents the free flow and the free chance of choice of companionship or whatever it is in any phase of our city life. And so integration of this process is a process. It doesn't have an end which is defined as such and such a percentage of children of one kind or such and such a percentage of the other. This is concerning us deeply in the school system at the moment, and you read all kinds of things of the school system sometimes even moving children from one district to another. Sometimes these children happen to be of different races because one school is overcrowded and another one isn't. And we still have people in 1960 in the city of New York. Actually, in one case we had an, over in Queens, of picketing and talking about opposing the idea of some children coming to a school because of race. It would be, as I say, a rather strange concept in a sophisticated town as this, but this could still happen, and it is happening. Well, you might say to me pretty quickly that, after all, this is really what's involved in the residential pattern and the way people live, and it just so happens that people live like this in many parts of the city. All one group live in this part of town, all another group in this part of town, and those with high incomes live in this kind of structure, and those with middle incomes live another kind, and you have all kind of segments run across the city. Well, this is true, and this is another thing we've got to watch out for pretty closely, because a beautiful concept that was once known as the neighborhood concept, out of which came the neighborhood school, as the place around a school of a certain distance where a certain number of children went because it served that district. But unfortunately, somebody else has taken that neighborhood concept and distorted it, has taken it away from educators, so to speak. Well, of whom am I talking? I'm talking about real estate operators. I'm talking about mortgage bankers. I'm talking about city planners who have taken the concept of neighborhood and wrapped another idea around it, which is homogeneity. They say a neighborhood should be homogeneous if it's to be respectable and have property value. Therefore, it means that people of all one kind should live in it. One kind economically, one kind socially, certainly one kind racially and ethnically. This is a concept that has done untold damage to the neighborhood concept. If any one group of people have used this kind of concept, which, by the way, you see, is private decisions, by the marketplace, not decisions of government. And that's why, again, in this city, as the first city in the country, we passed a law that my commission also administers, which says that in multiple dwellings in this city, it is prohibited to discriminate against anybody on account of race, religion, or national origin. Until we open up the housing supply to the same bargaining and the same free dispersal I spoke of originally about pupils and parents and so on, until we have a freer flow through the whole marketplace, we will be stymied in many efforts at intercultural understanding and intercultural education, because the conflicts always come at the lines of division, at the margins of the ghettos, at the places where there are the separations, rather than in places where people through a normal course of events have come to live together. We're then saying, in our efforts in the city, we're talking about just replacing heterogeneity, if you wish, instead of homogeneity. We are interested, therefore, in the housing policy. That it be, if we're going to talk about an open city and open schools, we're talking about an open housing market. That the housing in the city is to be open to bargaining by anybody. But this sounds strange to even say it, because this is a economy in which practically everything you want to buy is open to bargaining. Anything you want to furnish the house with, it can be bought in any store in town. You can bargain for its price. Television sets, shoes, hats, coats, anything. But when it comes to the house, there are still severe limitations on the bargaining power of a dollar in the hand of a man who happens to be of one race and the hand of a man who happens to be of another. Now this to me is subversive. This is un-American. This won't do. Because this is a free, open, competitive system we're building here. And anybody who then restricts it, anybody who gets in the way of the free flow of the possibilities of sound intergroup relations, to me, is harming the very fiber of American life. In other words, we are not commissioned by social action and by affecting policy, by working in a number of different fields. We hope, laying the groundwork so that the leadership of the type of thing you're doing is also part of our system. We're concerned about in-service training in various of the city departments that concerns itself with sound group relations. We are concerned with getting the arrangements so that if children of different groups and parents of different groups, as you have here, can come to know one another as individuals and come to know there's good, bad, and different and indifferent ones among all groups, you will have gained a strength that I think is resident in what you're doing and is evident here. This we would like to see all of New York City have the possibility of. I said that the pressure of time is on our necks. We won't have time to play with this much longer. The only reason New York passed this law and set this commission up that I'm on is that the city of New York has decided it costs too much money and it costs too much trouble. Here we're trying to do a redevelopment of a city. We have great and grandiose plans about clearance and redevelopment. What do we run head on into? The minority groups, so-called, are in these very areas that they need to clear, and they don't have places to move easily and flow through the housing market, and it thwarts these plans. Then we have segregated schools growing up where tensions of kinds develop and where we're spending a lot of money to try to readjust it. These are the areas where the so-called tensions develop. So that it costs too much to the city. So that we're now saying we're doing these things not for anybody's benefit, not for Jews, not for Negroes, not for Catholics, not for Puerto Ricans, not for anybody else, for the welfare of the city itself, for the very integrity of the city. Just as I said, if we are to maintain any kind of leadership in a world now, which is at least two-thirds colored, or someday the census taker is going to have to switch it around. Have we're talking about white and non-white. When we take world census, we're going to have to talk about colored and non-colored, because the majority lies the other way. And when you get into the United Nations and You see the great growth in just this past 2-3 years and what's happening to the numbers of African nations getting their freedom and coming into the United Nations and the great Asiatic peoples all across the world, that this is getting to be something of great and wide concern, in which the minority is a different picture than it had used to be. It's in this context that we don't have time to play with this, because this becomes our moral position in the world. And the world is looking at us in every step of the way in this. And the Soviet Union will not let anybody in the world miss anything that we do that is in error in this field. But whether there was a Soviet Union or not, whether it ever put us under pressure or not, but for the very integrity of the nation that is built on concepts that started back in the 1770s when we laid down a Declaration of Independence and a Constitution and principles that we said we would live by for our own integrity, it becomes more than just the issue whether this is the nice and comfortable thing to do, but the moral thing to do, and the thing that will mean survival in a world that is changing fast under our noses.
I think we're all indebted to Dr. Horn for outlining some of the things we've done and some of the things still to be done, and for posing some very provocative questions. More of this as we go on, Dr. Horn, doing the work of the school and in our classrooms and in our parent gatherings, continuing with the work of these conferences even through the year. I'd like to break into the formal atmosphere now to tell you that we're in for another treat, this time from our students. And again, Dr. Horn, I think you'll be very interested to see how we live what we teach. Mr. Studer will tell the group and you something about what it is we're going to see and how it grew. Mr. Studer.
What you're going to see now is really part of the beginning, the preview of tomorrow's conference, because it deals with producing materials for intergroup education. And with regard to tomorrow's conference, let me say that you should add to your list on the brochure two names: Dr. James Allen of the Board of Education, who has spent 3 decades working for intergroup education. He is an added member of our panel. And also Red Thundercloud, a representative of the American Indian population in our city, who has been working for materials about the Indian that give an adequate picture of the Indian. This morning here at school, we had an assembly program, and some of the people here present were on the stage as part of a panel of some 14 or 15 students who had read, each of them had read one of the books, either the award-winning book or the recommended books. These students, knowing nothing about what was coming, were then asked talk about the intergroup aspects of their books. This is an assembly of children from 4th through 8th grades, and they talked for a whole hour, and everybody listened attentively. And from the audience, we had participation from all of those from the 4th grade up. I mentioned this because these students talked about different aspects of intergroup relations in our history. A Northwest Indian who was captured and became a slave of another tribe and had to adjust to the life of that tribe. A white boy who got involved in the Underground Railroad. two great Indian leaders, Chief Joseph and Tecumseh, and I bet you've never heard of them, and so on and so forth. The reason I mention that is because this illustrated the kind of education we are working toward. This would not have been possible had it not been for a number of wonderful books that were published this year. We need more materials of various kinds, and this is what this conference is about. What this all adds up to is a complete, rounded picture of what our American heritage means. We have not had that picture before. We have not known the whole America. Our culture, the way that we got our image of what America is and what we are, has not been adequate, because our experience as a nation has been an intergroup experience from the very beginning. And this does not come through in the literature that our children see. It does not come through the variety of peoples and the interchange, the borrowing, the intermarrying, the conflicts, all of that does not appear in the materials that our children get. We've made a beginning, and when people talk about intergroup education, sometimes they talk about the fact that the potato was an Indian product, or that we got certain words from France. Contributions, that's the word. This is a tiny little beginning of what we mean, but it is really a sort of a caricature. It doesn't matter that the Indian contributed the potato and the tobacco, but it does matter that the Indians and the white people had an important body of experience. And the great Indian people who fought for freedom are not known by us. In our own state, Joseph Brandt, in the Middle West, Tecumseh, and so on. Children don't know about these people. We read now in our textbooks that there was a Dr. Carver, and he got a lot of products out of peanuts. Well, this is no disrespect to a great man, but we certainly have been salving our consciences with Dr. Carver. The whole of the great experience of the Negro people with the white people, this whole story we don't begin to know, and this is what we should know, because this is part of our culture, our heritage. It's not a part of the Negro Americans' heritage. Europe is, we came from Europe. We borrowed, when our history books say American backgrounds, they talk about Europe. Part of my background, part of my heritage as a white American is Africa. And part of the Negro's heritage is Europe. This is all ours. And it's this picture of America that will eventually be so that when we think of fighters for freedom, we won't think just of Patrick Henry and Paul Revere, but we'll think of Nat Turner and Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, which gets me to my point. This program could not have appeared without some materials that have not yet been published. Mrs. Buxenbaum, our eighth grade social studies and English teacher, has spent 4 years digging into the story of Sojourner Truth. And without these materials, this particular thing could not have happened. It started last fall when the seventh grade went up to the little village of Hurley in upstate New York and saw an old stone house that was the house where Sojourner Truth, whose name was Isabella, lived when she was a little girl in the cellar of this tavern. She told the story, it was taken down, and we know that this was the place. We roamed around in that little town, and then that evening we saw an unfinished statue by a person that has been associated with this school, an artist, Inge Hardison. And that gave something of the feeling. Then when the group got back here, they began to study the Civil War period, and Mrs. Buxenbaum read from her manuscript. After that was read, we asked each student, because they were studying poetry at the time, we asked each student to write a poem about the part of Sojourner Truth's life that meant most to them. And they wrote poems, and by some strange, miraculous reason, these poems all fitted together with a little bit of whittling and so on into a whole. And then our dramatics teacher, assistant teacher, Carlton Varney, directed this performance, which you are going to see, which was given as an assembly program during Negro History Week. And with that lengthy introduction, if you people will sit over here, be part of the audience.
She vowed she'd help set them free. She was raised in the cellar of the Hardenberg home until the time came that she was sold. Bring your troubles to God, my dear. When Belle's mother said this, she had no more fear.
A trembling girl with a brave look in her eye looked around for a familiar face, for she was on the auction block, which will become a well-known place. Mau Mau, will I ever see you again? While the mother weaves in and out of the men, looking for her baby. Her baby's already 8, that's so, but it's awfully young into the world to go. Sold for $100 and some sheep? The Belle couldn't complain. she made not a peep. Inside her, though, was a raging storm. Why, she wondered, were some people born slaves instead of being free, like born free, Mama, and also me? It's terribly unfair and cruel, she thought, and there were the roots of the life battle she fought.
Her new mistress was cruel, often had her flogged, but Belle did as her mother said, and brought her troubles to God.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
Are there to explain me? Only two, a common slave and my master's daughter. Well, not many can say that. 12 years I've been on this earth, 8 with my mother and 4 alone. But my master, everyone's master's been with me. He made this day, that free blue sky. That's what I should be and will be. So get away, Pebble, and the rest of you pebbles trying to block my way. You won't get away with it. I'm equal with you. No better, you understand, but no worse neither. Maybe I am better than you. Maybe that's why you're trying to keep me under your thumb, whipping me and giving me such work so I'll fear you. Why, there's nothing to fear. 12 years I've been fooled, but never, never again. Someday you'll let me free. All that both of us have got to do is wait, and you'll see. What am I saying? Mom always told me to obey the master. I'd better get back. There's work to do.
Someday I'm going to be something. I can tell. Mama always said that folks who look ahead will be something.
Again, Belle was sold to a man owning an inn. And what was even better, she now wore a grin. She learned to tell tales while living there, because here it was that she had no care. But alas, this happiness was not to stay, and she was sold again and taken away. She was sold to a family, the name of Dumont. She worked very hard, and of her they grew fond. Belle fell in love while living here, but they could not marry because of fear. But then she married one of Dumont's slaves, and 5 children to him she gave. Dumont promised her in a year she'd be free, and when the day came she was full of glee. "But what is this?" cried Dumont when she came. "I ne'er said such a thing, I swear, by my name." She went to God, told him what Dumont said. She decided to go, so next dawning she fled. 2 days she walked, as on she went. 2 nights on the road, with her baby she spent.
She went to the Quakers and was taken in, for those people believe slavery a sin. She told them her story, as sad as could be, and then they decided to help get her free.
In order to do this, the Quakers were told, both Belle and the baby would have to be sold. Demand agreed, and was willing to sell. And so the Quakers freed Baby and Belle.
And listen on further, and you will be told of one sojourner truth with her heart of gold.
Of vice and sin. Sojourner was unhappy. She missed her kith and kin. Her son got into trouble, then sailed away to sea. He sent her many letters, but to her misery, she couldn't even answer. She never knew where he'd be. So 5 long years went rolling by, and no more letters she received. She knew her darling son was dead. She bowed her head and grieved. Oh God, if my poor son is dead, please take his soul to you. For he was far away from home, and only 22. For he'd done no intentional harm, or no unforgivable wrong. Sojourner sighed, and dried her tears. She thought of her struggles in former years.
Yes, it was God whose words did tell me. Yes, I'm sure that it was he. I will help my people always to be happy, well, and free. For I'm on the road to freedom, to the land of liberty, and all of whom wish to may come along with me. I have left the crowded cities. It's the country folk I'll see. And I'll tell of the sins of slavery, that all people should be free. And I will have reached my destiny, and all my liberty, when I reach full freedom, and full equality.
Where are you going, Belle? Going east, going east. You won't live well, Belle. You'll never feast. You won't live well, Belle. I turned my back to the city. I could see my coming life. So I turned my back to the city and my crowd, his lot, and his wife. I'm giving up some. I'll give up all. I'll find a new name. 'Til be me that they called. It can't be Mary. It can't be Anne. It won't be a name that's too much in demand. Sojourner, I said with high exclaim. Sojourner again. What a funny name. Excuse me, Lord, 'tis a gift from you. Excuse me, Lord, this name shall do. I was dirty and hungry and thirsty. My legs hold no more. Then like the greatest of miracles, stood a house with an inviting door. My name is Sojourner, a traveler I be. I'm tired and hungry and thirsty. With heaven's help, I know you'll help me. Well, come on in, that woman did gravel. I was off in a while, I stayed a while. I thanked the woman, ready for many a more mile. Sojourner what? The very idea. So what of it? It comes from here. It's the truth that God has given me the name. It's the truth that I'm walking to spread his fame. It's the truth, he's the truth, and I'm the truth. Yes, sojourner truth, because he's the truth.
Sojourner Truth throughout her life never looked back. Remember Lot's wife?
Walk, walk, walk. Walk, Sojourner Truth. Walk on the road to freedom. Walk on to free your people. Walk on to free women. Walk, walk, walk. Yes, Sojourner Truth walked. She helped free women. She helped free slaves. But she must keep walking.
One time at a convention for women's rights, the preacher raised Cain, and the husbands tried with all their might to make their wives go home. But Sojourner had the will and power to keep them all in hand. They listened to her message. They listened to her speech. They listened to this old woman who so many people did teach. Walk,
walk, walk. Yes, Sojourner Truth walked. She helped free women. She helped free slaves. But she must keep walking.
A Negro! A Negro! Everyone cried as Sojourner kept walking and was given the eye. Where did she come from? Who let her in? But Sojourner kept walking and gave a wise grin. She waited patiently for 2 days and nights while others were still winning debates, quarrels, and fights. When the meeting was just about over and all in favor of men, Sojourner stood and took her stand to defend. The ladies of the board said, "Don't let her speak." But Frances Gay said, "She might have the will and the power we seek."
Well, children, when there's so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that 'twixt the Negroes of the South and the women of the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what is all this here talking about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arms. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as any man, when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have bore 13 children and seen most of them sold off to slavery. And when I cried with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women ought to be able to get it right side up again. And now they're asking to do it. Men better let him. Blige to you all for hearing me. And now old Sojourner has nothing more to say.
Now Sojourner's speech was over. No more hissing from the audience. No more heckling from the boys. Now there was nothing but stillness. Then a loud roar of applause. Everyone ran to shake her hand and praise her with the highest praises. But Sojourner was familiar. Oh, so familiar. With those joyous praises, but always willing to shake a hand and make another friend, Sojourner took her stand to defend.
Sojourner Truth, a slave was born, and from her family she was torn, a servant she knew what to be, and worked to set all slaves free. With faith in God she traveled the land, and worked and taught and made people understand. A Sojourner Truth will always be proud and sing her praises clear and loud.